morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Deng Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, June 18th, 2018. A spokesman for Machar's group says the Kir Machar meeting is still on in Addis Ababa.
And he's scheduled to have the face-to-face meeting on the 21st with President Alpha Kiir in Addis Ababa as per the invitation of the Prime Minister of Ethiopia and Chairman of IGAD. So this is what we know and this is what we are on schedule for.
And some in the South Sudanese diaspora say they want a seat at the table of future peace talks.
If there was to be a success between the government and the coalition of the opposition, we would like to see the diaspora being represented and taking an active role.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A spokesperson for the SPLM-IO says opposition leader Riek Machar is expected to arrive in the Ethiopian capital on Wednesday with plans to meet President Salva Kiir for face-to-face talks on Thursday. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
Mabior Garang, the chairman of the Information and Public Relations for the SPLM-IO faction loyal to Riek Machar, confirmed the rebel leader will arrive in Addis Ababa on 20th.
And he's scheduled to have the face-to-face meeting on the 21st with President Alpha Kiir in Addis Ababa as per the invitation of the Prime Minister of Ethiopia and Chairman of IGAD. So this is what we know and this is what we are on schedule for.
Garang denies that the venue has possibly changed. Last Friday, government spokesman Michael Makwei said the South Sudan government wants a Kiir Machar meeting to take place outside of the countries that are members of the East African bloc IGAD. Makwei said there were competing interests among IGAD member states, which include Ethiopia. It seems as that there is some sort of undeclared competition, Makwei said, and suggested that face-to-face talks be held in South Africa. Garang says the meeting of the two leaders will go ahead as planned in Addis and will smooth the way for lasting peace in the country.
The two principals are the ones who are really the final authorities, and from time to time we have the government delegation, for example, saying that they have to go and consult. So with the two principals meeting, there will be no other authority to go to. And then at the same time, the deadlock, which is being caused by the two major warring parties, will be resolved.
Garang says it is too early to anticipate what exactly will be on the agenda, but said Machar and Kiir are expected to focus on the peace process. He urged all South Sudanese to support the meeting and to stop all revenge attacks that have been occurring in the country between the government and armed forces.
Part of the root causes of the conflict is not Dr. Riek Machar or even President Salva Kiir for that matter, but it is some of the hatred that we have for each other, and I think we need to look into ourselves so that we can reduce some of this hatred so that we can be able to move forward. And all of us must participate in the process of finding peace. It's not in the hands of the leaders alone, it is in all our hands, and we must all participate.
If the two leaders meet in Addis this week, it will be the first time they come face to face since Machar fled South Sudan in 2016 after fighting broke out between the government forces and forces loyal to Riek Machar in South Sudan's capital, Juba. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
A coalition of South Sudanese activists in the diaspora called the United Voices of South Sudanese in the Diaspora. The new group is asking the IGAD Special Envoy for South Sudan to invite leaders from the diaspora to attend the next round of the High-Level Revitalization Forum. Nyok Gore is a South Sudanese civil society activist in Melbourne, Australia, and a member of the group. Gore says the voices of the diaspora should be included in the search for peace, since they played an important role in the referendum leading to South Sudan's independence.
If there was to be a success between the government and the coalition of the opposition, we would like to see the diaspora being represented and taking an active role so that the energy that is outside with the diaspora also can be channeled into a constructive engagement. And diaspora have been left out for too long, but we call that we want to sit at the table.
you are saying that you are disappointed for the lack of responsibility and care shown by both the negotiating parties and the IGAD heads of states, and you're saying that they are allowing self-interest groups to overshadow survival needs of the ordinary citizens of South Sudan. Who are these self-interest groups?
There are leaders that have continued to take advantage of this situation for too long, and it's a high time that there are civilians that have been left to suffer within the country and outside, that they should be given a chance. That's why we call for these leaders who are negotiating for their positions to at least also consider the suffering of the innocent victim of the current conflict that is between the political leaders due to their power struggle.
Listening to the leaders of the various warring parties speaking from Addis Ababa, each of them have been saying that they don't want to sign a peace that is not good for their people. The opposition would say, we want a good peace for our people. The government will also say, we want a good peace for our people. And so here you are calling on the leaders of the warring parties to negotiate in good faith and bring a lasting solution.
We as South Sudanese should be the one to call out the leaders on both sides of the table to at least come down and accept that at the end of the day, you know, they can sign some agreement. It may not be 100% full faith, but at least somehow consider the sense that they are there on behalf of many South Sudanese that are left to suffer simply because these leaders are not trusting each other.
Nyok, several leaders in the government in Juba, including the information minister Michael Makwei, came out publicly saying that the people in diaspora are the ones fueling the war in South Sudan, sending wrong messages on the social media. They are calling on you, leaders in the diaspora, to work for peace.
Yes, we acknowledge that. There is no doubt the diaspora have been playing a negative role in violence in South Sudan going back to 2013. It's a biggest challenge. It's an issue. We are so divided. We have a lot of influence over what goes on in South Sudan and in villages, whether financially or through our words. But you've also seen some of us taking up, you know, a role. There are also other diaspora members that have went back to South Sudan playing a critical role within the government and outside the government in supporting, in building up a young nation, which is South Sudan. And that should not also be a generalization that, you know, the rest of the diaspora outside are the one doing everything. No. There is a population within us that is much affected, that is so traumatized, and just want to criticize, but not offering the alternative.
That's Nyok Gore, a South Sudanese civil society activist in Australia and member of the United Voices of South Sudanese in the Diaspora. He was speaking to my colleague John Tanza from Melbourne, Australia today. SPLM-IO rebels have welcomed a push by the U.S. government to freeze assets of leaders fueling the conflict in South Sudan. Last week, a top U.S. official who was on a working tour of Africa called on Uganda and Kenya to stop the flow of corrupt South Sudanese money into their countries for real estate and other investments. A rebel official says the SPLM-IO will cooperate with any regional or international investigations into investments financed through corrupt proceeds. Waki Simon-Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
Last month, the U.S. government proposed asset freezes and trouble bans, along with the other sanctions on six top South Sudanese leaders accused of blocking the peace process in South Sudan. The UN Security Council voted to delay a decision on those sanctions for a month pending a review of the warring parties' commitment to observe the ceasefire deal signed late last year. U.S. Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Sigal Mandelka said U.S. officials believe hundreds of South Sudanese government and opposition leaders have siphoned money from South Sudan resources and are depositing it into Ugandan and Kenyan banks or real estate property. Mandelka said Ugandan and Kenyan lawmakers and bankers have the responsibility to stop corrupt South Sudanese from profiting from the 4.5-year conflict. Manasseh Zindo, a member of the SPLM-IO Political Bureau, says his party welcomes U.S. campaign to stop the flow of illicit South Sudanese funds into Uganda and Kenya.
The neighboring countries have a responsibility to ensure that peace and stability is in South Sudan and that stolen money from South Sudan is not being banked in their countries.
Zindo says SPLM-IO officials accused of investing ill-gotten wealth in neighboring countries are willing to testify in courts of law on such allegations.
We are not panicking. We are not worried. Our people who have been mentioned, for example, like the chairman, he will be able to clear his name. And let those ones on Salva's side, including Salva himself, also clear their name.
But Mayuen Makol, spokesperson of South Sudan's Foreign Affairs Ministry, says imposing sanctions, including freezing the assets of South Sudanese leaders, will not eliminate South Sudan's problems.
The sanctions are not helpful at this stage because we are on the track to bring the peace to the country. And the phases that I have gone with the revitalization show the commitment of the people, the stakeholders to the peace.
The Nairobi-based Daily Nation newspaper reports in today's edition that Kenya rejects pressure from the U.S. to seize Kenyan property owned by South Sudanese leaders reportedly purchased with the proceeds from corrupt money. The paper quotes Macharia Kamau, a foreign affairs principal secretary in Kenya, as saying that his country is capable of seizing properties from illicit proceeds, but will only act within the context of international practices through the United Nations conventions. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a top Ugandan official says the government is working to get children off the streets. Find out where the children are going after this.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your favorite cultural tradition and why?
When in the evening, people used to sit together when we were small. Elders, you know, in the evening, they share stories. You know, they tell us past histories. They tell us events that happened during their period, during their time.
What I love about the tradition of the Hausas or Fulanis is the way they wear their clothes. The clothes we use, the atamfaya. There's this Asian tradition of the Hausas, like two different wrappers, you tie one and you cover up yourself with one. I love that one.
I love my culture, and so all activities, I like them. So there's no particular one I can say I like and this one I don't like. So there's no favorite.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Uganda's Ministry of Gender and Youth Affairs says it's working with the police and other security organs to take children off the streets and to government centers. Minister Florence Nakiwala Kiyingi says there are criminal elements who traffic children from rural areas to Kampala to use them to beg on streets. Reporter Mugume Davis Wakarinj files this report from Kampala, Uganda.
It's raining here, and about 30 children attend a basic science lesson at Safe Street Children Homes in the Kampala suburb of Kamocha. More than 50 children, mainly former street children, live here. Other children grace the downpour as they play soccer, soaking in sweat and raindrops. 16-year-old Dennis Rochoro is one of them. Rochoro was trafficked from the Karamoja region in the eastern Uganda in 2012 when he was just 10 years old. He says life on the street is very challenging. Lochoro did not have access to food and used to sleep on people's verandas, who would usually be abused by owners and guards.
At around 10, they beat you. You try to go some veranda and you sleep there. At around 5 or 4 in the morning hours, again they come, they beat you. Like that, and the life was not really good. I could gun time when it is lunchtime. When I get someone who has finished eating, then when he has just left some leftovers, then I just beg, they give me.
Rochoro was rescued from the streets in February from Katwe slums and is now undergoing psychosocial counseling as well as education. According to the Minister of Gender and Youth Affairs, there are more than 1,000 street children in Kampala alone, including those as young as 6 months old. Minister Nachiwala Chiyinji says many trafficked children are used in criminal activities.
We have established that the emerging and leading cause currently is that being on the streets is because of some unscrupulous individuals who have been encouraging children, especially from Karamoja, to come to Kampala based on promises for better life and only to engage them in street begging as a business.
Nachiwala Chiyinji says there are also some individuals who operate illegal children homes. She says the government will close such homes and investigate the culprits. For example, she says only 70 children homes are cross-registered in her ministry, while some more than 560 are not. She says these children suffer physical, psychological, and emotional torture. They're exposed to harsh environmental conditions, hunger, and abused and discriminated against. Irene Malunga Banoba is the program's director of Save Street Children Uganda, which helps to provide support to former street children in Uganda. She says the most important way to deal with this problem is to fix the reasons why these children come to the streets in the first case.
They need to empower the families where these children came from, such that these children are able to access basic needs where they in the places where they live. Health, education, good living conditions. They can access food. We need to talk to community leaders at the grassroots, LOCs. Everyone should get involved.
Now that the young Lochoro is back at school, he dreams of becoming a mechanic. And Malunga believes helping children like him realize their dream is the best way to build a nation. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Eight Kenyan security personnel were killed in an attack by Al-Shabaab fighters Sunday in northeastern Wajir County. The area has been a frequent site of attacks by militants crossing the border from Somalia. Raul Ambor reports for VOA from Nairobi.
The incident is said to have occurred around 2:30 p.m. on Sunday. The security personnel were on patrol when they were attacked near the town of Bojigaras. Authorities said the car the security officers were traveling in ran over an improvised explosive device. After the explosion, Al-Shabaab fighters opened fire. Isa Ahmed Abdi is a member of the Wajir County Assembly.
They started shooting at them, and then they killed all of them, only to leave one who was still alive, but we are bringing him to Wajir Referral Hospital. He succumbed to the injuries on his way.
Authorities say after the attack, the militants fled towards the Somalia border. Ahmed said locals had expressed their concern about an impending attack, and the information was passed along to the security forces to no avail.
It could have been prevented because the public have actually given a first-hand information that these elements were there, and these elements themselves also said that they are going to do an action that the people will regret.
Northeastern Kenya has been the site of some of Al-Shabaab's most deadly attacks. In December 2014, the group killed 38 non-Muslims at a quarry in Mandera. In April 2015, gunmen stormed the Garissa University College, killing 148 people and injuring more than 100. This is the second Al-Shabaab attack in the county this year. In February, militants killed 3 people at Kasa Primary School. Al-Shabaab has targeted Kenya in retaliation for the country's involvement in AMISOM, the African Union force in Somalia that backs the federal government. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
More than 600 men, women, and children, including Sudanese, who had hopes for a better life, were reunited yesterday when their rescue ships were allowed to dock in Spain. The Aquarius, operated by Doctors Without Borders, pulled into the port of Valencia. The passengers were greeted by more than 2,300 Red Cross volunteers and other humanitarian workers, including police, doctors, and translators. A huge banner reading, "Welcome Home," was displayed. Their landing comes a week after Italy and Malta turned them away. About 100 of the migrants were on board the Aquarius. The others were transferred to two Italian military ships to avoid overcrowding. The World Cup is well underway, and in typical World Cup fashion, fans saw some upsets as well as some unexpected wins over the weekend. Croatia upset Nigeria with a score of 2-0. Mexico also stunned Germany, winning 1-0. France beat Australia 2-0 on Saturday. Argentina and Iceland tied 1-1, and the Brazil-Switzerland game also ended with a 1-1 draw. Tunisia will get its World Cup campaign started today with a tough match against England. It's unlikely that England will be overconfident because the team is trying to bounce back from weak performances at Euro 2016 in Iceland and the last World Cup in Brazil 4 years ago. Tunisia had a decent warm-up to the World Cup with 2 wins, 2 draws, and a loss to Spain in its last 5 international friendly matches. In other plays today, Sweden scored a 1-0 victory over South Korea, and Belgium is playing Panama right now. Here's VOA's Gwen Uten with more on World Cup play.
Over the past few days, we have seen some of the top names in soccer play in their World Cup openers, and hopeful fans have traveled across the globe from countries like South America, Saudi Arabia, and Africa to cheer their home teams on. With more on those exuberant fans, we'll hear 2 reports, first from VOA's Mariama Diallo, followed by Henry Ridgewell reporting from Moscow.
Arriving for the opening match at Luzhniki Stadium in Moscow, Russian and Saudi fans were optimistic and in high spirits.
We will win for sure. Yes, we will win.
I believe that Russia will win 2-0 because they are the best. Saudi Arabia is...
No.
Well, Russia did even better by winning 5-0. From claps to chants, football fever is sweeping Russia as it becomes the stage for what looks like endless festivity. Other fans are still arriving. This one from Peru is here to cheer on a team that hasn't participated in the competition in 36 years.
Beautiful city, nice and sunny, nice weather. We're going to root for the Peruvian national team. Nice.
Daniel Vielma flew in from Venezuela.
We feel that it's going to be a great tournament, and we hope that. We've been in 2 different World Cups, and we have really high expectations for Russia.
While his country of Trinidad and Tobago did not qualify this time around, Victor Comos made the trip and is supporting a team that has won the cup 5 times.
I am supporting Brazil. Trinidad and Tobago is not here on this occasion. We were in Germany, but at least we were able to knock out the USA on this occasion, as they knocked us out in 1989. We expect an exciting game.
A great start for the Russian team, something every fan hopes their team will emulate. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Peru, Colombia y Argentina, Uruguay, Brasil, Costa Rica y Panamá.
Moscow has become a global mosaic of celebration. The streets around the Kremlin, heavily guarded and snowbound for much of the year, are transformed with Latin passion and African rhythm.
Everything is new for us, it's new culture, it's new language, and it's very difficult the communication, but we are very excited.
The people are very nice and it looks very nice.
We are all united, Americans, Europeans, Asians, everyone united.
The locals have not seen anything like it.
Everybody is so friendly to each other. This is an atmosphere of festivity. It's an extraordinary event, much cooler than New Year.
Some have traveled here even though their own countries have not qualified, like 12-year-old Abdul Jabbar from Sudan.
Hello, we are here in Moscow. The weather is wonderful.
Nigerians living in Russia put on a welcoming party for their traveling supporters.
We are going to win the cup. I'm optimistic.
The party to the fullest. Experience what it means by bringing all Nigerians together. They like grooving.
After the partying, a bit of culture. Moscow's ornate metro system is now a kaleidoscope of teen colours as visitors explore the city. Russia is eager to show off its cultural attractions, from St. Petersburg's art galleries to the less discovered Islamic heritage in host city Kazan. Thousands of volunteers are on hand to help visitors like Spanish-speaking Yulia, eager to ensure it is a smooth tournament.
There are no impossible situations. You just have to calm down for a second, think, and solve.
And if you get lost, perhaps the best advice is simply to follow the noise. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News in Moscow.
Follow the noise and apparently follow the beeps. I have to mention that after Mexico's surprise 1-0 victory against Germany on Sunday, jumping fans shook the ground so hard it set off earthquake detectors. Mexico's Institute of Geological and Atmospheric Investigations picked up ground movement following Mexico's game-winning goal and then issued a tweet that read, "Artificial quake in Mexico City due to celebration of goal by the Mexican team in the game against Germany." Boy, they are having a good time in Mexico City and in Russia. Something to look forward to here in the U.S. come 2026. From Washington, I'm Gwen Uten. And that's our show for this Monday. We leave you with the song Doni Doni by Usa Menez.
Je me demande comment tu fais pour toi là-haut. Comment tu fais pour toi là-haut. Oh,
la saucisse.
Je me demande comment tu fais pour toi là-haut. Comment tu fais pour toi là-haut. Oh,
s'en fout de toi.
Il est maillé. Sunguru ya bene de Dunyaba. Il est maillé. Sunguru ya bana de Dunyabana. Il est maillé. Kamele ya bene de Dunyaba. Il est maillé.
La réussite a un nom.
Yuaï, le docteur du sous-sol, qui transforme le chigom en médicament. Je me demande comment tu fais pour toi là-haut.
Comment
tu fais pour toi là-haut.
Tu as parlé.
Je me demande comment tu fais pour toi là-haut. Comment tu fais pour toi là-haut.
Vrai, vrai.
Listening to Os Menes with the song Doni Doni. I'm Ayen Deng Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. We'd like to hear what you think about the show. You can tell us on the web at southsudan@voanews.com or reach us on Facebook. Our title is South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
I